I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, a show for curious cooks and eaters.
Hot sauce is truth serum.
Hot sauce is truth serum. All right, you're going to find out what I think about my mother right now. Welcome to Pepperfest 2018. Okay, sure, I mean, that probably doesn't sound quite as exciting as like Lobster Fest or Pizza Fest, but think of this. How many foods really have as much reach around the world as the pepper? Mild or hot, almost every cuisine uses them in some form, from sweet paprika to the Carolina Reaper. And so we wanted to spend an hour basking in their fruity, dusky, sweet, smoky, bitter, and yes, incendiary flavors. So in this episode, we've got some chit-chat on a savory caramelized pepper paste, an elegant French pepper powder, killer guac and chiles rellenos, and, like you heard just a minute ago, we're gonna have a hot sauce tasting that's gonna get a little emotional. But first, we're gonna take a step back to ask, why do so many cuisines feature peppers? I mean, they're not native to Asia, Africa, Europe, or Australia, so it's not like cooks in Thailand or India have always just gone back into the bushes to grab some. And how does a fruit that basically hurts you to eat it not go extinct? For answers to these questions, we turn to Heather Arndt Anderson, who wrote a book called Chilies, A Global History. Hey, Heather, thanks so much for talking with us.
It's nice to talk to you too, Francis.
So you are a botanist, actually, so I would love to start with a little bit of a plant nerd question.
Yeah, go ahead.
So, as I understand it, the reason why fruits are sweet and aromatic is because they, you know, that entices animals to eat them, and then the animals walk away and then poop out their seeds somewhere else, right? So they propagate the species, right?
That's right.
So with chilies, what could possibly be the evolutionary advantage to hurt the animals that eat you?
Well, you know, most fruits do look enticing to animals who spread the seeds, but not all animals are created equal. Mammals taste things differently than birds, and birds and mammals are both have a hand in spreading seeds around. The thing with birds, though, is that they don't have capsaicin receptors in their mouths, and so they can't actually taste the spiciness. And that's why birds have had such a hand. Well, they don't have any hands. They've played such a role in spreading chilies, whereas mammals have tended to avoid them. Non-human animals, I should say.
Oh, so actually, that's genius. That's brilliant, right? So then the idea is if I could choose, like, for this orangutan to eat me and move, like, 16 feet, or I can choose for this bird to eat me and spread my seeds 15 miles from here, I can be all over the place if I can just, like, be styled in a way where only the bird will want to eat me.
Well, that's right. Yeah, and so chilies have had a real evolutionary advantage in selecting for birds as the propagators of their seed versus mammals.
But let me ask you actually about sort of the more human side of the movement. As sort of famously, right, peppers are native to the New World, to either Mexico or Central or South America, somewhere in that area is where they originated. So can you tell us a story of how they then got to the rest of the world?
Yeah. So Columbus made a couple of visits to the New World. He had an interest in finding routes to South America or the New World because he couldn't travel through the Indian Ocean. He had to find new ways. The first time he came, it was just the planting his flag and whatnot. And the second time, though, when he came in 1493, that's when he started realizing that there was some cool stuff in the New World that he could bring back to Europe. He brought chilies, among other things. I think vanilla was in there, too, to Spain. And the Europeans spread them from Spain to Italy and northward from there. But it was when Portuguese explorers came to Brazil a few years later and brought the chilies to Goa in India that chilies were really able to spread to Asia and Africa and to the people who could really do something interesting with them.
Huh. Actually, that's a question I have too, right? Because those are cuisines that are known to be, you know, chili forward. I mean, we would say spicy, but I guess chilies are technically not spice, right? But you think of South Indian cuisine, you think of Thai cuisine, you know, those cuisines in Southeast Asia and South Asia you talk about. Why is it then that there seem to be some cultures that really took to the chilies and some didn't as much? I mean, they showed up in Europe before the Portuguese brought them to Africa and Asia. So, you know, why is German food not as hot as Thai food, I guess?
Well, Germany is an interesting situation because right when chilies were kind of blowing up in Europe, the Protestant Reformation was also happening. And so Germans didn't really want a lot to do with Catholic countries like Spain and Italy. They just weren't really very involved in the goings-on of Catholic countries. Versus Hungary, who had a lot more contact with the Ottomans and with Muslim travelers, and so they were exposed to it more. In Asia, though, spices were an exotic trade commodity that were definitely commodified, and chili fit in really well with all of the pepper and prickly ash, or what we think of as Sichuan peppercorn, that was being used already. Spices like ginger just were so complementary to chilies, and chilies could be grown very easily in it was a similar climate in South Asia as we have in South America, a little hotter and drier, but still really easy to grow these peppers. And the people who had contact with Portuguese explorers had a real interest in taking these vegetables, which were very nutritious, or their fruits, and having them in their own gardens to spice up their food. In East Asia, you know, they got chilies a little bit later. They had to come from India through Southeast Asia and then up from there. So Korea and China got the chilies just a little bit later. But they had such an exchange in their food ways that it was just really like the news traveled fast.
But Japan, which actually had direct contact with the Portuguese, right?
Yeah.
Like chilies didn't really make much of a splash in Japan. Although, you know, Korea and China are right next door.
Yeah, Japan got sugar and tempura from the Portuguese as well. But I haven't been able to figure out why Japan hasn't embraced the chili as much as their neighbors. I'm sure there were some social dynamics at play, cultural dynamics. There is, you know, the shichimi togarashi that uses a little bit of chili, but it has, you know, citrus peel, ponzu peel, and other spices in it as well. And so, yeah, I'm not sure why. Maybe it's due to their climate or something. I haven't been able to figure that one out.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, like, yeah, some of these things are, you know, there's a geographic sort of relationship, and you can see how things move with trade. And sometimes it's just like, oh, cultures are kind of like, yeah, not for us. It's fine.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Portugal never really adopted the chili into their cuisine either. I mean, they have vindaloo and piri-piri sauce, but it's not as prevalent as you would think, considering how much contact they had with chilies and what a hand they had in spreading them to Asia and Africa.
Yeah, that's incredible. Let me ask you another question that's a combination of cultural question and plant nerd question. But so chilies have always had capsaicin. They've always had the hot stuff in them. How did sweet peppers come to be?
Oh, well, Hungarians, who were among the first Europeans to truly love chilies, began breeding in the 1800s and were able to slowly develop a chili that was less spicy. I think, as it is with anything, there's always going to be a little freak occurrence of one individual organism that has a trait that humans like, whether it be a corn with a larger ear or a tomato with a redder skin. And I think that they, through just breeding and kind of experimentation, were able to find a milder variety. And then they really focused their breeding efforts on finding a way to consistently produce this milder chili for their paprika.
And that's how we eventually got something like a sweet bell pepper.
Yeah, it's just, it's really incredible to me how all of the different types of chilies and peppers that we eat today really came from just a couple of species. Now we have hundreds and hundreds of varieties just because humans found one quality that they liked in one little organism and were able to kind of manipulate that into something that would be so different over the course of a few hundred years.
Yeah. And I guess the question remains, did we manipulate the chilies or did they manipulate us?
I know. Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun. All right, Heather, thank you so much for talking with us today. This is super, super interesting stuff.
Thanks for talking to me.
Heather R. Anderson is the author of Chilies, A Global History. Okay, so we have human breeders, not natural evolution, to thank for sweet bell peppers, but there's one human in my life who has filled my life with sweet peppers. My 2-year-old daughter loves red bell peppers. I mean, she just loves them. And, you know, when you're talking about the sweet love a toddler feels for something, that basically just means she's liable to get up and start screaming for them at any moment. So I wrote about this in a column for the New York Times Magazine a little while ago. But basically, I had to figure out what to do with the stacks of red peppers that we keep on hand for her on the weeks where, like, poof, she just decides she doesn't care about them anymore. And I started to think about this great recipe by the chef Justin Smiley, where you basically throw so many peppers and onions into a pot that they release all this juice, and then you brown some chicken legs and just tuck them in there and you braise them in that pepper broth without any stock or wine, and it's just fantastic. And so from there, I got the idea of, well, if the peppers and onions are tasty enough to form the broth for a braise, what would happen if you just cooked them all the way down to, like, a glaze? And the answer is very good things happen. The onions and peppers caramelize, so you have this sweet, complex flavor, and the peppers are pretty much melted into this schmoo. I love to spread it on toast and top it with, you know, basically whatever to make a little lunch. Like, some ricotta cheese and mint leaves is great. Some tuna salad or maybe smoked whitefish salad with some dots of sriracha is awesome. Or, you know, just go straight up classic with Italian sausage and Parmesan. So many things are great with this melted pepper spread. So here's how you make it. You thinly slice 2 medium onions and just get them going in a big pan with a 1/4 cup of olive oil. No cover, you know, big saute pan, and just kind of let them cook. Salt them a bit and stir them, you know, a little bit here and there just so it doesn't brown too much. Meanwhile, you thinly slice 1.5 pounds of red bell peppers and 4 cloves of garlic. And when the onions are really soft, you add the peppers and garlic, salt it a little more, and let that cook for about 10 minutes. You'll see the juices start to come out. And after about 10 minutes, the juices should have pretty much cooked off. And then you start stirring just a little bit more often, maybe once or twice a minute for the next 10 minutes or so, until the whole thing is like a jam. You can smell all those caramelized flavors coming out of the pan. It's going to smell incredible. It's going to make your whole house smell like it. You salt a little bit more to taste, add a splash of vinegar, maybe a little bit of chopped thyme. Cook for 1 more minute just to cook that harsh acid from the vinegar out, and you're done. And I'm telling you, it tastes so good. Like, my daughter hasn't asked me for peppers for weeks, and I'm still at the store buying them just to keep making more of this stuff. And coming up, it is definitely getting hotter in here.
Gotta give Francis a minute here, folks.
Tell me about the fact that I can't breathe right now. Is that normal? I'm Francis Lamb, your hot sauce guinea pig, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters, and I'm your host, Francis Lamb. Mexico is obviously one of the spiritual homelands of the chili, and the range of chiles in Mexican cooking is just profound. Dried, smoked, fresh, burnt, it's the foundation for tons of dishes and salsas and moles. But in so many Mexican restaurants in the US, chiles rellenos, the dish where the pepper is the star is, you know, kind of off in the corner, sad and lonely, like there is no love left in the world for a stuffed pepper. Well, Bricia Lopez wants to change that. She's the owner of Galleguetza, which has been called the best Oaxacan restaurant in the United States and is definitely home to one of the greatest chiles rellenos I've ever had. So, hola, Bricia. Thanks so much for coming in today.
Hi, Francis. Thanks for having me.
So, you are on a mission, you told me, to change people's minds about chiles rellenos. So, why do you think they have a bad rap?
You know, so when I moved here, I was 19 years old when I moved to Los Angeles. I went to a restaurant once with my dad and I ordered a chile relleno just because in Oaxaca, where I'm from, they're one of the best things that our cuisine has to give to the world. Mm-hmm. And I received it and it was just like not what I was used to, to say the least. It was just like soggy, greasy, Chile-ish thing. And I was like, what is this? And every time someone comes to my restaurant out to eat, Galagetza, here in Koreatown, I always recommend chiles rellenos. And I always get like this pushback from people, like kind of like, not my fave. And I'm like, but why? No, really. Like, taste it. And it's one of these dishes I always push. Mm. And 10 times out of 10, everyone always is like, this is the best chile relleno ever. I didn't think chile rellenos could be like this. And I'm like, well, yeah, because they're Oaxacan chile rellenos, which makes them that much better. But they're just so different. I just want to change that perception that people have. Like, close your eyes. I want them to imagine what I grew up eating, not what I experienced here the first time I ate one.
Yeah. So what makes a good chile relleno?
Well, you know, I feel like every dish, you know, just there's just so much layering that happens, right? Like, one of my favorite things to have inside a chile relleno is this picadillo de pollo that we make. And it's shredded chicken, and it has tomatoes, onions, almonds, raisins, a little bit of chocolate shaving or brown sugar, salt. Oof. And it's just this beautiful, like, sweet chicken picadillo. And then, of course, it's stuffed in a chile. We use a chile de agua that comes from Oaxaca. And it's spicy. And then the batter is just so just like fluffy and beautiful and just soft. It's not crunchy. It's not overly oily or anything. So you kind of get that like rich fat and like sweetness and spiciness all together, like singing in your mouth. And you're like, oh,
yeah.
I always like to have it with like a tortilla and avocado or like in a sandwich.
Okay, so you have this like beautiful chicken stuffing that you use, the picadillo. Or I think you in the restaurant, I remember having it also with cheese, like a nice like chewy cheese with some like epazote they use for some flavor. Mm-hmm. But the chile, tell me about the chile itself. You use a particular chile. Are there other chiles that we can use? And how do you prep the chile?
So the chile has to be roasted and you have to peel the skin off. And okay. Then, you know, you're left with sort of just like the meaty section of the chile. And it just obviously when you roast the chile, just completely transforms the flavor profile.
Yeah.
And Anaheim chile, I think it's a good option. I hope chiles de agua will be readily available all over the U.S. at some point just because they're just so delicious.
So you want a chile that's sort of big enough to stuff, but like not like something super hot, right?
I personally really like the spice that you get in between the egg and you know, the sweet chicken. Mm-hmm. Chiles are like, you don't know which one you're going to get that's going to be too spicy and which is going to be just right, especially like, you know, in the market, you can't really, you know, tell. But you want something that gives it that like 360, you know, you want the sweetness and the spice to kind of come together. Mm. But if you get a chili that's not too spicy, I don't think that will take away from everything.
Right. And so the chile is roasted and you cut it open, you stuff it with whatever you're stuffing it with.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about the batter. Because like I've had chiles rellenos where they're not battered. It's just like the roasted chile with like a stuffing and mm-hmm. I'm kind of like, wah, wah. You know, I feel like little bit sad trombone. But the mm-hmm. batter, like what is in that batter?
You know, it's just eggs. It's just eggs. Huh. Oaxaca really loves eggs. You know, in Oaxaca, there's this one dish called higaditos. The recipe calls for 35 eggs. One chicken, kid you not. So we just love our eggs. So it's just basically a batter. You get all the egg whites, you whip them until they're fluffy, and then you add the egg yolks back, and then you whip them again, and that's it. Like the chile rellenos without the batter is a little bit more accessible for people. When I'm saying accessible, I think like the idea of really doing the batter makes it like not a weekday meal, more like sure. a weekend project.
Yeah.
If you have a good chile and it's really roasted beautifully and you want to stuff some chicken in there, just put it in the broiler. You could still have it, you know, and I think it's still, by definition, a chile that's relleno, which is a stuffed chile by definition in Spanish. And if you want to save a few, put them in the fridge and then, you know, save them for the weekend. And when you have a little bit more time and do the batter and give that project a try, I think either of them work. You just have to have a good chile and you have to take the time to roast them and peel the skin off, and it's well worth it.
Yeah, yeah. And then like, oh, that's so brilliant because it's not really like a batter. It doesn't get like crunchy or crispy. It's like that egg
no,
then fries in the oil.
Yeah, almost like a beautiful like egg fluffy, like clouds, like an egg cloud.
You know, it's almost like, it's like if you imagine like frying a meringue.
Yes,
it's like
it's
fluffy
exactly what
and
it is.
Soft. And then when mm-hmm. you sauce it in the end with like some of that, it's usually just a really simple tomato sauce in the end, right?
Super simple Oaxacan tomato sauce. So you just bite into like this egg cloud, biting into this spicy chile, and then finding a present of this just sweetness chicken concoction you've just done. And it's just so well worth the time you've invested in. You know what I mean? I don't know.
I 100% know what you mean.
Am I romanticizing this too much?
No, I want to go cook it right now. This sounds so delicious. Thank you so much, Bricia.
Oh, thanks for having me, Francis.
Bricia Lopez is the owner, along with her family, of the restaurant Geleguetza in Los Angeles. It is the most fun restaurant name to say ever, Geleguetza. And she gave us a recipe for chiles rellenos de picadillo. You can find it at splendidtable.org. And by the way, you know how she kept saying they're a great weekend project? Well, it got us thinking about other serious cooking projects. So keep your ears open for our project show in a few weeks. Our next piece is something that for some of you probably would have been a dream gig, going into a hot sauce emporium and tasting our way through the shelves. Now, for me, I like spicy food, but I have to admit I was a little bit nervous because it's one thing to feel like your insides are on fire, and it's another thing to feel like your insides are on fire with a microphone rolling to capture your reaction for all of eternity. So when we went to visit Noah Chamberg, who owns this terrific hot sauce store called The Heatonist, he assured me that our afternoon would be about flavor, not firepower. So Noah, thank you for having us here at The Heatonist today.
Yeah, Francis, very happy to have you by.
So it's been a long time since I've actually walked into a hot sauce store, and I think the first and maybe last time I did that was maybe 20 years ago. I remember I was in college, it was a long time ago, and it was just like row after row of bottles that were just meant to scare me. Like, they had names like Slap Your Mama and Insanity Sauce, and it was like really clearly about like an arms race, and it was about like intimidation. But this store is not like that. It's very beautiful. You have beautiful furniture, nice turntables, and the sauce labels don't seem to be about like macho aggressive masochism.
Thanks, Francis. Yeah, we definitely have taken a different approach to hot sauce. And from the start, it was very much for us about flavor. We love hot, but it has to really taste good. So in the beginning, I wouldn't even consider sauces that had like devils and skulls on the label or any of that gimmicky stuff. Now that we've been more established as, you know, having this good taste, I'm more open to have fun on the label, do what you want. It should reflect the spirit of the maker. But we've definitely moved as an industry beyond just trying to scare people in some macho arms race.
And you have three sauces here that you're going to sort of help me taste and walk my way through. And
yeah, I pulled out three that I thought would be, you know, a good good demonstration of the types of different flavors you can have in hot sauce, but also looking at different heat levels and different ideas about what you might pair them with. So let's start with Pirate's Lantern Pepper Sauce. And this is a Bajan-style hot sauce. It's made by two brothers who live here in Brooklyn, but they're from Barbados. And in Barbados, they always put mustard in the hot sauce. And this family recipe also adds to it horseradish and a little bit of dark rum. And of course, it's made with Scotch bonnet peppers, the traditional chili of the island.
Okay, so Scotch bonnets, which are really hot peppers.
They're hot. Yeah, they're a close...
I'm stalling now because I'm getting nervous.
A close cousin of the habanero. But keep in mind, you know, it has Scotch bonnets, but it's all about how much is in there. So when you read the label and you see hot peppers are the first ingredient, that's going to be a very hot sauce. But if it's after the mustard and vinegar and things like that, then okay, you know.
They might be taking it a little easier on you?
Yeah, the chili content's not too much. They want you to be able to use a lot.
Okay. I'm smelling it first, again, because I'm mainly just stalling. But it smells wonderful. You can definitely smell mustard. There's like an oniony, garlic-y kind of smell. I don't catch like the horseradish, but...
Yeah, horseradish, a little more subtle in there, but definitely get the turmeric, the onions.
Oh, wow. That's like, you know what that's like? That's like the greatest hot dog you've ever had in your entire life.
That's the keyword. And I like to think about hot sauces often with keywords. Like when you taste this, what do you think about when you first taste this sauce? And for this one, hot dog is definitely the word. So it's a great sauce for this time of year when people start to think about their barbecues and sandwiches in the summertime. So it's really a great summertime sauce.
Like that heat is definitely there. It's kind of, it's like a nice heat. There's like a little tingle at first, but then like my mouth feels warm right now. It doesn't feel like
it's well balanced and, you know, definitely something that you can enjoy easily. It's not supposed to make you sweat. So a good lunchtime sauce for that reason. We don't want anybody getting all sweaty at the office or studio. OK, Okay, next up we have another medium heat sauce. This one's actually our newest sauce, and this is Hot Ones Los Calientes.
Okay.
And this was, we wanted to make something totally unique, something that would be great on wings, but really great on all food. So we have some smoked serrano peppers to give it a little bit of a smoky edge. There's apricot with a bit of culantro and lime for acidity, and apple cider vinegar. Let me know what you think.
Mmm.
Yeah, right?
It's a really vegetal flavor. Like,
yeah.
It's almost like a pumpkin-y, squashy kind of flavor. That's really delicious. And that smoke is just... I was nervous with the smoke because I think when people smoke things, they go really hardcore with it. But this is like...
Yeah, it's easy to overdo it.
That's delicious. So, and the last one...
This sauce is the Heatiness number one, Szechuan Ghost. And it's with ginger and lemon and about 18 ghost peppers in each bottle.
I have never tasted a ghost pepper. Am I going to be on the floor?
You'll be okay. You might get one tier. But eating a fresh ghost pepper is definitely a different ball game from eating it in this sauce.
Let's talk about that for a second, because I find myself more just instinctively afraid of raw chilies than cooked chilies.
Yeah, raw chilies.
Like,
yeah.
They're hotter.
They're much hotter. Anything that you're going to do to the pepper is going to change the heat. So smoking, drying, cooking, these are all going to affect the molecules that create the heat reaction, the capsaicin that's in there. So definitely, once it's cooked into a sauce, it's totally different from the heat that you're going to have on a fresh pepper.
Mm. So that encourages me. And here we go.
Yeah, this sauce is really a flavor journey. So as you taste it, the first thing that you taste is the floral notes of the Szechuan peppercorn.
Mm-hmm, totally.
So those molecules are going to float right up into your nose, so you're going to taste them first. And then ghost pepper is well known for its delayed heat. So it's a slow rising heat as opposed to something that you feel instantly.
It's coming.
It's coming, yeah.
Oh, boy, it's rolling up the driveway.
Yeah, ghost pepper will take about a minute to get to its full heat sometimes.
I definitely taste a lot of that lemon. Like that lemon rind, lemon zest flavor is really, really nice. But yeah, it is definitely getting hotter. Getting hotter in here.
Those combinations of flavors, the peppercorns and the lemon and the ginger, even though the sauce has so much presence and so much flavor to it, because of those types of flavors, it actually pairs really easily. So you can imagine this on tons of different types of dishes.
Yeah. Tell me about...
Gotta give Francis a minute here, folks.
Tell me about the fact that I can't breathe right now. Is that normal? Tell me about cooking with them.
Yeah, cooking with hot sauce can be a lot of fun. It's a great way to add a ton of flavor and to make the overall cooking process a lot easier. You know, you take this sauce and use it to dress up whatever you're cooking. It's wonderful on a steak, but also one of my favorites is to just put it on some asparagus and take them out to the grill. And then a favorite sauce here is garlic and jalapeno hot sauce. That's with olive oil and loaded with garlic and jalapenos. And I say to people, you want to make an impressive meal that's really simple, just do some boiled shrimp, some pasta, and just dress it with this sauce. And all of a sudden, it looks like a gourmet meal, even though you only had three ingredients.
So it's about taking the flavor components of that sauce, kind of looking beyond the heat of it, and be like, okay, what are the flavors here? And then matching that to what you would often eat with those things.
Absolutely. We say it's food that goes on food.
It may be the last meal you eat. Thank you so much, Noah. This is awesome in the most literal sense.
Thanks a lot, Francis. I really appreciate you coming by.
Noah Chamberg is the owner of The Heatinist. And if you're in New York City, they have two locations and they'll be happy to guide you through a tour of their hot sauces too. My dear friend Doc Willoughby has a thing for great little ingredients, and I can't tell you how many spice mixes or rhizomes or tubers he's introduced to me and to his readers over the years. And when we told him we were doing a show on peppers, he brought up his favorite magical French pepper powder. We were intrigued. Okay, Doctor, you have always been... Now, you don't know this. I've never said this to you, but you have always been my powdered pepper guru.
Wow. That is an awesome title.
Like, I learned about Aleppo pepper through you. I learned about Urfa pepper through you. And now you're here to talk about, I don't know how to pronounce this, piment d'Espelette.
Piment d'Espelette.
Piment? French?
Well, in America, you say piment because we don't know how to do it. So I just call it espalette and very leave nice. Out the piment part. So the other pepper that I always loved is pimenton de la vera, which is from Spain.
Yeah, and that's smoked.
It's smoked, heavily smoked, and but it's awesome. It's a great pepper. And through that, I got the espalette because espalette comes from the Basque region of southeastern France.
Oh, okay.
And it's a very different pepper. I have sort of, it's become my favorite pepper recently because it's mildly hot, sort of like all the ones we were talking about. It's not super hot, just mildly hot. Mm-hmm. And it's also sweet, just a little bit smoky, and it's got kind of citrusy flavors. And to me, it's got a sort of aftertaste of peaches.
Oh, cool.
I know, right? Come so on. It's like rich and deep and just a little bit hot. And so you can use it in anything and it makes it better.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can easily get it online or in any spice shop. So it's, I mean, you, every weekend pretty much, I'm not sure I should be confessing this, but every weekend pretty much, I make a grilled cheese sandwich with a bunch of espalette on top. It has become my favorite lunch, and it's so simple. Or you put it on any kind of eggs, it's great. There's some classic Basque dishes that feature it, like eggs piperad or just plain piperad, which is a mixture of bell peppers and onions, and it's, you know, cooked a long time with a lot of espalette in it.
Oh,
there's
cool.
also a veal stew that's classic that they use it in. But, you know, you can just use it in anything. It's, you know, sprinkle it on anything you're eating, and it makes it taste better. I really like to put it together with a lot of salt, a little pepper, black pepper, and some powdered thyme, and rub it on lamb. Mm. So it's super versatile. And it has all those different flavors going on in it. So it's more dynamic than most other peppers.
This sounds amazing. I don't have any in my home. I want it. But, you know, sometimes I find myself when I'm buying something like this, like something that's really sort of unique, I always wonder if it has such a cool flavor, it has such a unique flavor, you know, what are the ways to really highlight that flavor?
Well, the people in the Basque region of southern France, where this comes from, use it in place of black pepper. So mm-hmm. they just put it on everything. And they also, I think an unusual use of it is they use it in chocolate desserts because it does have that sort of fruitiness that goes well with chocolate. So I think, you know, for me, my favorite ways to use it are just sprinkled on things like a grilled cheese sandwich or a lamb chop, which is what I'm going to do tonight or whatever. And then if you use it in chocolate desserts, it's surprising.
Yeah.
And so that's always a good thing.
And are there like particular brands that you should look for if you're shopping for this?
Well, two things. This is an AOC product, which means it can only be called espalette if it's grown around Espalette, the village.
Yeah.
So if you look on the top of any brand, it should have the AOC on top of it. So any of those will be good. But my favorite is an odd brand called Biperduna. But if you look online, it's one of the most prevalent ones, so you won't have trouble finding it. And it is a little milder than the other brands, and it seems to me it has a little chunkier texture, which I like, and it has to me a little bit more of that peachy flavor than some of the other brands, so I'd go for that.
Cool. Well, thank you. And what time is dinner?
Come on over, 7 o'clock.
Right on.
Bring the family, we'll be ready.
John Doc Willoughby is an award-winning writer and editor. You can find his recipe for a classic piperad at splendidtable.org. And coming up, America's Test Kitchen's Tucker Shaw talks to us about the Cubanelle pepper. And I get a chance to talk with you. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. All right, let's talk, you and me. You can always call us 1-800-537-5252. Leave us a voicemail if you'd like, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And we have Rebecca calling. What would you like to talk about today?
So my boyfriend and I live in the city of Chicago. We both started new jobs that have this sort of lovely and interesting West Coast vibe where they serve us like breakfast and lunch. And it's really nice, but I love to cook. I love to prepare food from scratch. And I was wondering if you had any ideas for, like, how can I still go to the farmer's market and enjoy cooking from scratch when I'm only eating maybe, like, three meals a week at home? I guess. Like what kinds of vegetables. I feel like I'm continuing to throw a bit of produce away because I'm not quite used to this new like schedule and shopping and stuff like that.
Oh, sure. Okay, so wow, this isn't like a dish makeover. This is sort of like a lifestyle, like a holistic lifestyle makeover kind of call. So, and you know, without knowing what your schedule really is like every week and every day, part of it is going to be, and I totally feel you because I, especially now in the summer or like just when the markets are great, I go there and I just like, yes, yes, yes. Okay, I'll take that. I'll take that. Oh, a bunch of turnips.
Exactly.
Sure. I know I need a bunch of turnips. I don't need a bunch of turnips. So
exactly.
It is a little bit tricky if you don't really have that much occasion to cook at home right now, or if you might decide at some point, like, hey, you love this benefit that your job is giving you. That sounds awesome. But hey, like, you do miss cooking. And so, like, you might decide, well, I'm just going to spend more of my spare time cooking, not for meals, not like to feed me tonight, but really hobby cooking, you know? So you bring more people over, or maybe you'll figure out, you know, you're going to have more dinner parties just to give you more options and more reasons to use all this stuff that you're picking up.
That's
and in the meantime, a way to still keep using really nice seasonal produce is preserving, pickling, and canning. This is so geeky. But one thing I'm really into is like slow cooking things and seeing if I can like concentrate them into a jam. Like, I don't know. This is like, that's like my thing. My thing is like, I sit in front of a stove and watch peppers melt. Like, I love doing that for some strange reason.
And I'm kind of into that. I get that.
You feel me?
I freeze and pickle a lot. Yeah.
Oh, right on. Yeah, cool.
Maybe
so
maybe capture more. That's fair. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So like you can do the freezing, you can do the pickling, you can do the preservation. But something I'm really into is I have a lot of red peppers in my house because my daughter loves them. But sometimes she'll be like, I don't want them anymore. And now I have like 3 pounds of red peppers. And so I started by making like a peperonata, which is like a sort of classic pepper stew.
Okay.
And then I just kept cooking it and cooking it, slowly simmering it with onions and a little bit of garlic and olive oil. And I cooked it all the way down to it basically became a jam. And it was like sweet and savory and it tasted so good. But something else you could do that with is tomatoes. Like when tomato season it comes, like forget it. It tastes so incredible. So I'm really into that. And you can think about your juicier vegetables and trying variations of that. These slow cook down things where, hey, you can get away with buying 2 pounds of eggplant because now you cook it down to some like delicious eggplant confit, you know, and play around with things like that that they tend to keep for a good long time in the fridge. And then like you'll have these
beautiful little...
Yeah, it sounds
like something I could keep at work too.
Yeah, exactly. Like they're like beautiful condiments.
I'm totally going to do the pepper thing. That sounds really delicious.
Yeah, and I feel bad talking about it because I've been talking about peppers all show. But like savory jams. Get into them.
Okay, I will. That sounds great. Thank you very much.
Cool. Well, enjoy and congratulations on the job. Say hi to Chicago.
Thanks.
I miss I love it. I love that city.
Well, thanks. Have a good day.
Cool. Take care. You too. Thanks for the call.
Yeah, bye.
All right. We have David on the line. Hey, David, where are you calling from?
Oh, I'm calling from Northern Indiana with the WVPE station in Elkhart, South Bend area.
Great. Thanks for the call. What would you like to talk about?
I cook lots of cuisines. I have lots of cooking gear, but I normally cook for 2 or 3 people. Mm-hmm. In a few weeks, I'll have a bunch of out-of-state family visiting, so I'm thinking about meals made in a larger scale, which is a little out of my wheelhouse. And then also, one person is highly gluten intolerant, and I wondered if you might have ideas that might not have occurred to me for gluten-free meals for like 8 or more people.
Mm.
The only idea I've had so far is I thought I might make a corn tortilla enchiladas with salsa verde green salsa.
Yeah. Well, if you're going down a Mexican path, I think you're already in a great place because, you know, the main starch in many Mexican dishes and certainly many regions of Mexico is the corn tortilla, which is naturally gluten-free. So you're not having to get in a situation where you're trying to substitute something.
Yeah.
When this is just a natural part of the cuisine and it's delicious on its own terms. That's one of the really nice ways to look at something like a gluten intolerance or allergy is to find the cuisine that, you know, doesn't have to avoid that.
That's the road I'd like to travel.
Yeah. And for a group, for me, I think the biggest difference or the thing that stresses me out the most is how do you get all that food
served at the same time.
Yeah,
like time. That for me is the stressful thing. And I think in this case, you can certainly make a big sort of, you know, big tray of enchiladas, and if you want to bake them, if you, like in the baked style, you can certainly do that almost like a big lasagna style. And obviously, you can do one or two pans of that, and that's a nice meal that you can do on the sides and vegetables and stuff to go with that. Or something that's really fun for a big group, and if it's people getting together, they haven't seen each other in a while, is to do something nice and interactive. And maybe what you want to do is make a big roast pork shoulder, or a big pile of seared skirt steaks or something like that. Make a bunch of salsas, cook some like vegetables or some salads. You can do something like charred peppers, hot and sweet peppers together, or you can do a nice big pot of really beautiful black beans and a little bit of rice, and have a big pile of tortillas, a big pile of cut limes, a bowl of cut white onions, and a bowl of chopped cilantro, and a few different salsas, and have people sort of pick at this pork shoulder or at the skirt steak or at the fish or the chicken or whatever you want to do, and, you know, make their own tacos or hold the tortilla in their hand while they're scooping up beans. They can dip the tortilla into the beans. You know, just make a really nice interactive meal where people are, hey, talking to one another, and they're passing food to one another. And
well, I'm so glad you say that, because I really hadn't thought about this whole idea of an interactive thing, and I think that sounds great.
Yeah, you know, and that's the kind of thing where, like, a lot of things can be cold or room temperature. All of your vegetables and things like that can be served alongside. You only have to bring out the one or two hot things. And the one thing I would suggest is make sure your tortillas are warm, because a warm tortilla is really what brings it all together. Uh-huh. Yeah, so then it can be about having fun and people being like, oh, hey, can you pass me a lime? And
that's great advice. I appreciate this very much.
We'll enjoy it and enjoy the gathering.
Thanks. Okay, bye-bye, friend.
Take care. And remember, you can call us anytime. Questions or thoughts, 1-800-537-5252. Or email us through our website, splendidtable.org. All right, so we've been talking about different peppers all hour long, but how do you go about figuring out which ones you can substitute for one another in a recipe? Our producer Sally Swift went to Tucker Shaw from America's Test Kitchen for some advice.
Hey, Tucker Shaw, good to have you with us.
Hey, Sally, thanks for having me.
Hey, we have been spending the entire hour digging into peppers, and I have a question for you.
Okay.
Why do you think people have so many issues with green bell peppers?
Oh, yeah, it's true, they do. You know, I think it's
those
partly...
Those poor things.
I know, right? They're just so cute, but I think it's a little bit overexposure. I think they're so ubiquitous and maybe not so interesting, and there are so many peppers in the world that have something kind of more exciting to offer. Mm-hmm. I mean, they can be a little bit bitter and people react to that. Sometimes they're a little bit watery.
Yeah, they're really watery.
Yeah, but you know, they also have that really nice crunch and they're kind of refreshing. I don't know. I mean, I guess they're sort of neither here nor there for a lot of people. But you're right. They do inspire a lot of sort of strong feelings.
Yeah, but you are also seeing there are also a lot of other green peppers out there. And I'm wondering if you could kind of walk us through, you know, a couple of the varieties and talk about what you think are the best ways to use them. For instance, an Anaheim chili.
An Anaheim is great. You know, it's got just a tiny measure more heat than a green pepper, which really is starting from zero. Mm-hmm. It gives you some sort of mild vegetable flavors. They make a good substitution for example, a New Mexico green chili if you bolster them with a hotter chili like a jalapeno.
Oh, that's smart. So you pair them with that. And these are the long, thin ones.
That's right. They're probably about 3 or 4 inches long, a little bit wrinkly. They come to a very sharp point at the end, and a very, very pale green.
What about poblanos? Are poblanos something you can swap in and out for different chilies?
A poblano, I think, will really change the character of your dish if it does call for a bell pepper, because poblanos have quite a bit more heat.
Okay.
They do have a similar kind of texture. Like they're fairly firm and they will give you a little bit of that crunch, and they're much deeper color as well. So if you're looking for your green bell pepper to bring you that kind of bright, vibrant green, a poblano will give you something much deeper. So I would experiment a little bit.
That's good to know. Okay, and what about Cubanelles?
Oh, I love those.
Okay, so explain what they look like, first of all, because they do look a little different.
They do look a little different, and they are not so dissimilar from the way an Anaheim looks in the sense that they are sort of long and slender, and they have that beautiful pale green color. They're a bit larger than an Anaheim. They are maybe look a little bit shinier, but they sort of have these like long wrinkles down the side of them, and they sort of languorous kind of form to them, you know? And they are often merchandised right next to the Anaheim. So you have to be careful and make sure that you are grabbing the pepper that's a little bit bigger, a little bit plumper, and just a little bit shinier maybe than an Anaheim. They're a little bit sweeter than a green pepper, a little bit less bitter. Mm-hmm. They might have a touch more kind of fruitiness, but just... You know, they're not going to stand out in any dish and take over, but they provide a really nice kind of vegetable backdrop or filter that your other ingredients will come through.
And do you have a recipe that you love to use them in?
Totally. We have a recipe for arroz con pollo, which I am crazy for. Mm-hmm. Arroz con pollo is a very common Latin dish, and it's basically chicken and rice, and there are many variations to this dish, but ours is built, like many of them, are on a sofrito, which is a flavor base of vegetables. And in our case, this includes cilantro, garlic, and onion, which are all very strong flavors, as well as some chopped Cubanelle peppers. Okay. And the pepper, being so mild and faintly sweet, really helps keep the other ingredients in check. It doesn't overwhelm them, but it just keeps them a little bit contained.
So how do you put this recipe together? This is mommy food all the
way. It's total mommy food. It's total family food. Everybody's happy when you make this. And it's a one-dish meal, which is even better. So you take your sofrito ingredients and you put them in the food processor. And you've got onion, garlic, cilantro, a little bit of cumin for some sort of smoky spiciness, and the Cubanelle pepper. And you mince this very finely in your food processor. You take 2 tablespoons of that sofrito, stir it together with mayonnaise and lemon juice, and that's going to be your finishing sauce later. You stick that in the fridge while you're cooking the rest of the
Smart.
Meal.
Smart.
You grab a Dutch oven at this point, and you've got 6 chicken thighs, and you brown them in the Dutch oven for about 7 to 9 minutes on each side just to render some fat from the skin and get some browning going, both on the chicken and in the bottom of the pan. You want to create a fond that you'll scrape up later into the rice for extra flavor. So once you par cook those for about 7 to 9 minutes on each side, you pull them out to a plate, give them a little bit of rest, and you go back into that Dutch oven with a bit of chopped onion to soften, and then some medium grain rice to toast. And we choose medium grain rice here because it gives you just the right sort of starchiness that you need for this dish. And you add a little bit of saison, which is a prefab spice mix that you find in the Latin American section of the grocery store.
With that bright yellow color, right?
That's right. It includes annatto seed ground up in there, which really lends that beautiful, vibrant, almost orangey yellow color to the finished dish that you will recognize as soon as you see it.
Okay.
You've got the rice going, and you stir in some chicken stock, and then the rest of the sofrito. And along with that, some chopped olives and capers. And these will give your dish sort of a really bright brininess that will wake everything up at the very end. You bring this to a simmer. You nestle those chicken thighs back in. You cover it up, and you slide it into the oven for about 20 minutes to finish. And the reason we put it in the oven at this point is so that you don't risk scorching the bottom of your pot.
Right.
And Sally, when it emerges out of your oven and you pop the top off of that Dutch oven, you're going to be overwhelmed with this like incredibly deep and savory and just invigorating aroma that has so many notes in it. You'll almost be, your head will be spinning. It's so good.
And that beautiful color. It sounds just perfect.
It's gorgeous. And so you scoop out some of that rice and you maybe stack a chicken thigh on top of that rice. And then you bring back that sauce that you made earlier with the reserved sofrito and a little bit of mayonnaise and some lemon juice and just drizzle that over the top to really add a final note of like super fresh, bright vegetable flavors. It's so good. And when you're eating it, you're not going to necessarily taste Cubanelles. You're not going to think to yourself, oh my God, I'm eating Cubanelle peppers.
Right.
But it's doing its work in there. It's really rounding the edges of these other strong flavors in the sofrito to give them just a slightly softer lens. It's like putting an Instagram filter or something like that over your sofrito just to give it a little bit of a quiet kind of finish to it.
Oh, Tucker, you have proven green peppers have their place.
Thank you very much. Thanks a lot, Sally.
Tucker Shaw is editor-in-chief of Cooked Country. You can find the recipe for arroz con pollo at splendidtable.org. And that's our show for the week. I hope you had fun on our little capsicum run. And until next week, eat well, drink well, and tip well. Our production team includes senior producer Jennifer Russell. Jenny Lubke is our editor and technical director. Erica Romero is our associate producer. Kit Walton is our digital producer. Sally Swift is our managing producer. And thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.